again.
He'll come back for the second. India have won the test match. India have won the series.
They're going to get back for two. India are home. Lords goes wild.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of 81 All Out. In this episode, we're going to be reviewing the India-South Africa series that just concluded. This is Mahesh, and I've got two other 81 All Out regulars, Subhash, Cricket Couch. Hi, Subhash.
Hey, Mahesh. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for joining us. And I also have Sidhvi joining us as well. Hi, Sidhvi.
Hey, Mahesh. Hey, Subhash. Hi, guys.
So, what are your initial impressions of the series? Were you surprised by the domination of this Indian team? To some extent, even in our preview, we talked about the fact that India is going to dominate. But did you expect the scale of domination?
I do not know whether you can quantify scale of dominations. For example, if you go back to the India home series versus England, they won 5-0, 4-0. And even though England sort of was in the game at Rajkot and later on too, but 4-0 yeah. Sounds terrible. You could say India going to England and losing 4-1 looks terrible. It looks on paper that they were dominated, but the games were a lot closer than, say, England were in India. So I do not know how you quantify these. Is it based on number of runs scored by one
team? It's not based on the series scoreline of 3-love, but it's based on the fact that India, except for probably the first innings in Vizag, where South Africa built a little partnership, they were pretty much never in the game. So India never let South Africa even come anywhere near them.
Given the recent form of this Indian team and how they've performed both home and abroad, and they've always been competitive, even if situations are against them. Yes, this is kind of was expected. South Africa missing two of their legendary batsmen through retirement, not having, and also missing legendary fast bowler, not having the resources that is required to match up to this Indian team, playing in their home environment. There is a vast gulf between the two sides, and perhaps one could argue that slightly more than what was expected, because South Africa typically give themselves good account, compete. But fact that their fast bowling reserves outside of Rabada didn't look really threatening, made it look far worse than what one would have anticipated.
Going purely from the South Africa point of view, I think this is definitely their the series where they've been outplayed comprehensively in India. I mean, even in 2015, when they lost the series 2-0, all the games were played on turning pitches there. There were low-scoring games. So even though India was the better team and had the better spin attack and overall had the more ammunition, South Africa were never completely out of the game before like the second innings, you could say they were probably always going to struggle with India's spin attack, but at least as in terms of the contest, it seemed to be still alive. And with the pitches, you felt, okay, maybe India could also collapse for less than 100 or something. But in this series, the gulf was just so wide. And I don't remember South Africa ever having a series where they were so badly outplayed in India.
I think then there's another aspect of this series that made the viewers kind of realize that the gulf between the sides is much wider than what we thought, is the performance of the Indian Pacers. I know we're going to talk about them later on. The fact that it wasn't a runaway series with the Indian spinners dominating the visiting batting lineups. There's only one fifer. Ashwin took it in the series for the Indian bowlers. The rest of the wickets were kind of shared. So the fact that the Indian Pacers were also, you expect Indian batsmen to perform a lot better than the visiting batsmen on, Indian grounds pitches. And you expect Indian spinners to perform better. But the fact that the Indian Pacers also outperform the visiting South African Pacers, who, you know, who may not have the record to back it up as a group, made the picture look even more stark than what we'd have originally imagined.
But to some extent, the fact that Indian Pacers were going to be better than the South African counterparts should have been factored in at the beginning. I mean, we spoke about how Shami is always more dangerous at home than away, and despite his reasonably impressive displays outside. To some extent, that was already expected. But the fact that the Indian Pacers outperformed even their own spinner counterparts, although, of course, you can argue that the pitches are slightly more favorable to them than the spinners, but just the sheer domination of their contribution to the win, would you call it a marginal surprise, or do you think it's just the peaks and troughs of a very good fast bowler bowling in conditions that he's very good at?
You know, Umesh, he had that terrific series at home where he also had a match haul of 10.
Against West Indies, yeah.
Yeah, when he played at home in 2018. His kind of bowling is suited for kind of lower pitches and gives him a larger margin of error in terms of his line. And obviously, you have second inning Shami, trademark 81 all out. As you said, the way they outperform the Indian spinners, outperform the Pacers, we expect things to happen. But when both those things came together and they just kind of blew the opposition out, especially the top orders, and basically made the contest into a no contest, kind of drove home the point that India is at a level much higher than South Africa currently.
I also think that, the fact that it was Umesh and Shami, I mean, we know that both of them are extremely good bowlers in India. Umesh, even you spoke about West Indies, but you can even go back to that Australia series. I mean, the Dharamshala test was, Umesh was the one who opened it up before and India won that test and then went on to win the series. So I think the fact that Bumrah missed the series, Ishant Sharma missed part of the series, but Ishant wasn't the Ishant that we have seen in away tours in the previous cycle. And it was Shami and Umesh who basically, spearheaded the attack, not just the pace attack, but the whole attack. And they were relentless. New ball, or even when they had to come in later in the innings, or, bowl with the old ball, it didn't seem to matter to them when they were bowling. I mean, the lines, the lengths, and South Africa's batsmen were, had no clue. I mean, they had practiced against spin, but it seems that these two pacers really took them by surprise.
Of course, when visiting teams come to India, it's often talked about the fact that they grew up in an ecosystem where they're not used to playing as much spin, and therefore they tend to struggle. But you could possibly extrapolate that argument to this as well, that they wouldn't have won phased fast bowlers who get the kind of purchase from these kind of wickets that Shami and Umesh did. And more importantly, they wouldn't have faced this probing attacking line, which is fairly straight and off stump rather than outside and trying to get the edge. And when you're relentlessly attacking with a little bit of purchase and with supreme skill, the lack of practice or lack of exposure to that kind of an ecosystem shows up as well. And somehow this is treated as a lack of technique and a technical failure. Whereas if you fail against spinners, it's treated as inexperience and lack of exposure. Is there a bit of natural selection at play here that Shami, who was born and brought up here and who made his way through to the international cricket through, performing in these kind of wickets, is naturally expected to perform better and pose questions that they're not expected to easily resolve?
I think so, definitely. I think, there's long been a talk about how, Indian, like Kapil Dev bowled all his, so much of his career in India and the subcontinent, and yet ended up as a record-breaking bowler. But if you look at Kapil's record, it is better at home than it is away, as it is with Srinath. I mean, apart from Zaheer Khan, the top Indian fast bowlers have mostly been have a better average and bowling record at home than they have away. And I think that's partly to do with the fact that they have grown up in these pitches. They know the lengths to bowl. they know that, I mean, they've also played first-class cricket where you can go through extended periods of time without success. And then you need to find a way to get something out of the pitch. If you don't, they know that if you don't strike in the first half an hour or hour, things could be tough. So, yeah, the lines that they bowled, the out off stump, just outside off, I mean, the ball that, some of the balls that, you know, the Duplessis dismissal, for instance. I mean, in Australia or South Africa, that kind of a leave might have been totally fine. But, you know, to play in India, to play against these bowlers, to gauge that bounce, it takes its own level of skill, as it does playing against a spin. So, yeah, I think it's time generally that it's acknowledged that fast bowling in India and in the subcontinent in general is its own skill. And barring, say, Dale Steyn, or if you go back a little, maybe McGrath, Gillespie, there haven't been that many away bowlers who have excelled.
There is probably a simpler explanation, which is that the workload on the fast bowler, for an Indian fast bowler, while playing in India, is lower. That you're not expecting a fast bowler to bowl 6-7 hour spells, 3, maybe 4 times in a day. Because you're bowling basically, 20 to 25 overs a day. Whereas Umesh Yadav playing 2 test matches, bowling in 4 innings, bowled a grand total of 39 overs. The fact that you're bowling alongside bowlers, in this case spinners, who are wicket-taking threats in Indian conditions, allows you to be used in very short spurts. And you can be hyper-attacking where you're attacking the stumps. Bowling the line of stumps isn't a very attacking line, and also could be a very expensive line, which is why Umesh Yadav goes for runs. His economy, even in this test series, where South Africa did not make runs outside of the first test match in which Umesh didn't play, it was still like 3.4 or 3.5, something like that. It's a very attacking line for taking wickets, and also you can go for runs. But you're only bowling short spells, so it doesn't show up on the scorecard as like, oh my God, I went for 40 in a short spell. It doesn't look bad. You can go for 20 in a 4-over spell, and then you're taken off. So there is that buffer built in. So when you bowl alongside spinners like Ashwin, Jadeja, or before that, Harbhajan Singh and Kumble, you can afford to be a fast bowler that goes for wickets, attacks the stumps. And the conditions help you with the variable bounce to keep aiming at that. And when you go abroad, spinners are that much blunted and your backup is David Johnson. So, then you're brought back again and again. And are you fit enough to bowl your 24th over of the day and then come back and do it again next day and then the next test match and then in a 4-test series? That's why your Indian paces look that much better at home conditions.
Let's come to South Africa's batting a little bit. You go through the names individually, like Dean Elgar, Mark Trumpf, Faf, Bavuma, Quinton de Kock. These are pretty decent names. I mean, pretty good names. Even in these conditions, you could discount the fact that they're not going to perform as well in India as they do elsewhere. But even then, this is a pretty decent lineup, and you would expect them to put up some scores. And especially after a reasonably good start in the first innings of Vizag. Usually, teams struggle in the beginning and gradually find their feet. Pretty much, their best batting performance comes in the last test once they have acclimatized to the conditions better and stuff like that. But here, ever since that partnership between Elgar and de Kock in the first test, it's just been on a downward spiral. Were you disappointed with the batting performances even after accounting for the supreme skills of the Indian bowlers?
Disappointed more than, I mean, it's, I think they were up against some very good bowling and they probably also fell into the trap of focusing too much on spin rather than on pace. And, if you see that Elgar-de Kock partnership was very good. I mean, that Elgar 100 is probably one of the really, really good hundreds that we've seen, not just in India, I mean, anywhere. The manner, I was thoroughly enjoyed watching that innings as well as that partnership. And I was hoping that given that it came in the first test, I mean, it's still South Africa was still really at a poor position even after that partnership. But I thought that that would give them some kind of confidence in terms of their batting in India, in terms of facing the Indian spinners into the conditions. But they just couldn't come to terms with the pace bowling.
To answer your question, Mahesh, no, I'm not. I wasn't disappointed. I was surprised that after that 431 in the first innings, their first batting innings, that they never really matched. Then after those 200s, the highest score by a batsman, I think, was it was Keshav Maharaj 72. I think that was the highest score for South Africa after the de Kock, Elgar scores centuries. So collectively vanished. So, you know, Sidhvi summarized everything. I just want to add one thing to it about Babuma here. I think he's called as the little Sachin Tendulkar in South Africa. And the way he collapsed when the ball kept low, you know, how Tendulkar would, you know, squat down when the ball keeps low. And we have seen it in the 81 all out innings in Barbados. No, Barbados, he was edged. He has been bowled many times by balls that keep low and he squats down. Babuma did a very good tribute of that whenever the ball kept low and wiped out the stumps. So thought I'll add that in.
But Sachin squatting is like disproportionately exaggerated.
Yeah.
With Babuma, I can understand him doing that because the ball really kept low. Sachin, it could be like millimeters and he'll still squat as if it just shot through.
You know, I thought I'll just add in because he's Babuma is sometimes called as the little Sachin Tendulkar.
Well, but one
is he really called as that?
Yeah.
One thing,
he idolizes Sachin and he kind of tried to model his game after the master.
Oh, interesting. But talking about the strengths, playing to your strengths, we spoke about it in terms of bowling. I also think, you know, Barkram, in the second test, I mean, in the second innings of the second test, I thought he got a good start. He was playing, he was getting into his groove, and then he got caught and bowled to Jadeja. I mean, exceptional caught and bowled, one-handed cap. He had a terrible time in Sri Lanka and didn't seem to do too much better here, apart from that.
In fact, you guys discussed this in the preview. And to be honest, considering what we thought will be his weakness, I thought he coped up quite well. I mean, he got an absolute beauty from Ashwin in the first innings of the first test, which I think it would have dismissed most batsmen. But otherwise, he looked to be okay, to be honest. He didn't look as out of place as he did in Sri Lanka. I mean, with Harith bowling the arm ball, he was just a dead duck. But he looked a little more at ease here. Unfortunately, even the Jadeja cotton bowled was not really... It was a marginal sort of judgment error where he believed he had a little more elevation, but it's not the bowler outwitting the batsman completely. And he also got a couple of very poor LBWs because he was on the field for so long and they come back and there's so much pressure and a little bit of a lazy poke and he got LBW as well. So,
which if he had reviewed would have not been out?
Sorry?
If he had reviewed, the LBW would not have been out.
There were two. One of them would not have been out. Even in the first test, he got out similarly, right?
So, I mean,
he was out actually.
I mean, as you guys mentioned in the preview, you know, he had trouble in Sri Lanka, and you kind of expected the trouble to kind of continue. And he's good enough batsman that you'll eventually get used to playing in India or conditions that are not South African. So, you know, I think Ashwin mentioned in the podcast with me, like, sometimes it takes 4 or 5 tours to a place to really figure out what to do. And I think that applies to batsmen as well.
And it doesn't help that these are fairly short series, right? I mean, Sri Lanka was squeezed out of nowhere, just 2 tests. And although this was a 3-test series, he could only play 2 tests. So there's no, I mean, it's an argument that I made in the context of, you know, Jayawardene and Sangakkara. As compared to other great batsmen of that era, these are the two guys with very little sort of platform to build on when they go out and play. So when people criticize Jayawardene's away record, they don't factor in the fact that he didn't play as many tests on the trot as every other great batsman of that era got to play in foreign conditions. So you don't really build on your game. So again, when you go for a next two test series, you have to start from scratch.
I mean, there was a book called Saving the Test. It was written by...
the Economist guy, right?
Mike Jakeman, right? And there was a chapter spent on this pre-series preparations, you know, how teams would travel and, you know, if you went to England, you played like 13, 14 first-class games, really, in your tour, and you had time to get into form, and if you had lost form, there was time to get back into form in the middle of the series and all that. And that is gone. Now, you know, the minimum requirement for World Test Championship are two test series. So that's going to be the norm. It'll be interesting if people figure out a way I think the only way is to play in those conditions. And for example, Kohli said about how before going into Australia, even the 2014 series, he was already preparing for it from September. And Pujara is known to do those things, recreate conditions and practice on them for weeks and weeks before going on a series. I don't know whether it's a team concept or is it up to the players, in individual players driven to succeed in certain conditions, give themselves time before some series and do this kind of preparation so that they can go and succeed, give themselves a chance to succeed anyway. Kohli wanted to go play in England, but then hurt his neck and didn't play before the 2018 series. So I think it should become a team concept where they start planning ahead to series, whether it's India or West Indies or wherever else you're going to go play.
I think the A tours can serve as a sort of a substitute for the tour games. I was hoping that, Markram and a couple of other South African batsmen would have really benefited from that. Maybe, obviously you face don't face the quality of bowling that you do in a test. But, Rahane and Vihari acknowledged that it helped them in the tour of West Indies. They had an A tour just before the test series and then they played the test series. So maybe that could be a semi-alternative. But it's very tough.
That points out to the further specialization of players per format. You're not going to have this idea of AB de Villiers, or even for the matter, as poor a T20 batsman as Virat Kohli is, that sort of thing is going to vanish. Because, he played in the World Cup, which meant the players that played in the World Cup got rest before they went and, Indian players I'm talking, before they went and played in West Indies. So which meant Rahane and Saha and Vihari, they all played in A-side games in West Indies before the test series. So that luxury, so it's going to get further and further specialized. Vihari, sure, he is part of IPL franchise and so is Rahane, but they're not, setting T20 world on fire with their bat. With their skills. As much as would they like to believe, or the teams that have them and play them would like to believe that they would set the T20 world on fire, they are not T20 hitters. So they're going to get hyper-specialized. They'll be long-format batsmen, so they'll play all the eight tours, domestic four-day games, so that they give themselves a chance to be successful when the real tests when the teams play them in the test matches, that they're actually ready. Like, they expect them to deliver. Like, hey, you are our specialist, test specialist. So you have to deliver. And if you don't, then you lose your chance. So it is good that Rahane and Vihari actually performed in West Indies, and Rahane had a century here. Vihari only got one test match to play. But I'm sure Vihari will get a very long run in this Indian side, because the top order, especially now with Rohit Sharma, who also plays all formats for India, he's not going to score as many runs as he did here. I'm sure we are getting to the point where we'll concede the floor to Mahesh to talk about Rohit. But, Indian batting performances are going to be dictated by 5 and 6, which is Rahane and Vihari. They are the specialist test batsmen, really. And Pujara at 3. These three guys have to will determine the success of India abroad, really. Before we go on to the batsman of the day or the series, I had tweeted out maybe a few days ago, maybe in the third test match in Ranchi, that I'll be surprised if Mayank Agarwal plays, doubles his test played tally. Because he's got severe flaws in his batting technique. He squares up way too much. He's always caught on the crease. His weight is not properly balanced. And a lot of the times he gets out because his front heel hasn't even landed. He plays way in front of his pad. Way outside his off stump. I don't know. I mean, given all those flaws, I give major props to him that he scored the runs. His first-class record is pretty good. So I give props to him. But, man, once as an opening batsman, you have to have much more discipline. You're going to get caught out a lot more very quickly once there is a record of your long-form batting on video. People are going to take you apart. You have to have solid, different, tight technique, and I don't think he has it. And he doesn't have the luxury of someone like Rohit Sharma even. Rohit Sharma has shown a lot of discipline as an opener, but I don't think he's going to survive for another 7 test matches. I think he's just keeping the seat warm for either Prithvi Shaw or Shubman Gill.
That is quite a bold call. Although I agree with some of your assessment, especially the fact that the heel is still landing while he's playing a drive. And of course, that was kind of highlighted after his dismissal in Ranchi. But even during the course of his fairly impressive 100 in Pune, it was a fairly recurring thing where his heel was still landing while he was playing the drive. And it did appear to me that he could get into trouble. But having said that, he did okay in West Indies, where he was really tested by Holder. He managed to survive some really probing spells. And then in Australia, of course, he played against Cummins and Stark, and he's still...
The West Indies series I covered, so I kind of watched it close. I have no idea how he scored those runs. You shouldn't have.
I mean, I kind of see your point, but what is it that made him survive and score those runs? There's something about it.
I guess...
Apart from
that. I don't know. Maybe he's got very short memory, that the more he gets beaten, he's totally fine with it. He doesn't mind getting beaten constantly. As long as the runs come, he doesn't care. Maybe the team doesn't care. But the moment there are other options for openers, which will be sooner than later, because, you know, with the drug ban of Prithvi Shah, that will be expiring soon. Shubman Gill, already part of the squad against Bangladesh as well. Because the thing with test cricket, it's such a simple game. If you have flaws, those flaws will be found out sooner than later and will be ruthlessly exploited.
Okay. I have pretended enough
and
I've gotten rid of the excuse. Let's just talk about Rohit.
Yeah. Go ahead. Talk about Rohit.
Let me just add here before Mahesh can take over the floor that I was a little skeptical of him facing Rabada and Philander early up. I had mentioned that in the preview, and I thought that he would not be equipped enough to handle them. But the discipline and the manner in which he batted through the series, I mean, was admirable, especially that Ranchi, the way he played against Rabada, that first Rabada spell, which was an extremely good spell, the manner in which he handled that and came through and then went on to make that big score, I think, speaks volumes about his ability to... I mean, not only, he's a very good batsman. We all knew that. But then to take on the new role and... to bide his time, stay there, and then make the big score was fantastic. And of course, the way he smashed the spinners, I mean, he's been very good against spinners, but to actually take the chances against them and go after them and to then set them off the course, it was very, very good.
One thing I want to say is the Ranchi innings kind of makes the whole control data moot. I mean, it's if you take a large enough sample size, obviously it holds certain truths. There, you know, a lot of the deliveries that somebody would have marked down as not in control, Rohit Sharma was perfectly in control. That he was, he picked the line and he saw the movement and he was playing inside the line. And obviously he was getting beaten because he wasn't, he was getting beaten on defense, which is okay. It's, if you're getting beaten while playing a stroke, that's terrible. He's getting beaten on defense, which means his game was under control. So I just wanted to add that point. All right. The floor is yours, Mahesh.
No, I was quite nervous when he started. I mean, I was nervous not because I thought he wouldn't make a good opener, but primarily because of my stakes on his test batting. And I've been waiting for this for God knows how many years. In fact, the other day I went through Cricinfo's archive of Rohit Sharma articles. And thankfully, they have this. So they have an image for all the articles, right? And thankfully, they always color coordinated. So if it's about test cricket, it's always in white. So I skipped through all the in-between thing and I went through the white things and all the way to a report that Sidvi had written about Rohit being part of the squad when he was still covering cricket. So we've been talking about Rohit Sharma in the test squad since 2008, 2009, and then he was dropped for no reason. And then 2010, he nearly made his debut and didn't, and waited for another 3 years. In the meanwhile, quite a few, let's say less than Rohit Sharma kind of cricketers made their debuts. You know, this has been going on, and in fact, I even went through some of the Cricinfo commentary around his dismissal before coming on the pod, and the standard, templated, stereotypical, oh, he's lost his mind, he's thrown his wicket away, soft dismissal. I mean, I can understand you doing that once or twice, but I mean, at the end of the day, he's a solid first-class cricketer. He knows how to build an innings. You don't try to hit the cover of the ball every time you bat and end up with more than 60 Ranji Trophy average. He's a certified legend in the Ranji Trophy for sure. Of course, a lot of great first-class cricketers don't go on to make it big in Test cricket, and for a variety of reasons. And I would probably make a case in the case of Rohit that he wasn't given a long enough opportunity at one stretch. And you could see that even, I mean, that's probably the big difference, because he was always caught between this stamping his authority versus also playing it safe till you reach a point of comfort. In Sydney, for instance, he scored a couple of a 40 and a 50, and then he got out. Even in the last Australia series, where with the short boundaries in Adelaide, he tried to take on Nathan Lyon, and Cricinfo's description of that is quite brutal. And in fact, Chapley writes about it after he succeeded as an opener that this suits him because he settles down before spinners come on and then he can take them on. And he doesn't have to commit the harakiri that he did earlier. So he was caught in that space primarily because he didn't have the cushion of one big score. And even in the first innings here in Vizag, even on that wicket, Philando was testing him quite a bit. They were going for that LBW and bold that he exploited in South Africa quite well. And Sachin actually made a remarkable observation on Twitter where Rohit actually bats down the wicket, I mean, comes out of the crease to negate that line and the little bit of seam movement that Philando was getting. And then Quinton de Kock came up front. And then it was easier for Rohit to open up. And Sachin almost makes a very decisive statement saying, that's it. You know, that was the space when Rohit won the mental battle. And from there on, it was much easier for him to open up. And thankfully, it took someone like Sachin to make that point, because had he got out doing that, it could so easily have been interpreted as a batsman out of his depth in Test cricket, experimenting because he couldn't cope up with a good bowler, even on a fairly flat wicket. And since then, I mean, you could see that even he was nervous till he reached a certain decent score. And only after he scored 100, he could probably play a little more fluently. So the real sort of force of Rohit came only in the second innings on a wicket which wasn't coming onto the bat and it was holding up and down. And on that wicket, to score at that pace was just ridiculous. I don't think any batsman in the world could have scored at that pace on that wicket. And I enjoy that partnership between him and Pujara in that second innings, particularly because Pujara is probably the only other batsman who could play on that kind of a wicket against spinners and score so fluently. And after I think he took a while to settle down, but once he settled down, he started opening up. So I enjoyed that partnership immensely. And I want to go on tangent here slightly and make this point as well that, and this is probably the best Indian batting lineup in terms of playing against spin in a long, long time, because Mayank, for all his issues against fast bowling, is also a terrific player of spin. Rohit is a great player of spin. Kohli is extremely comfortable against spin. And Pujara is quite possibly the best in the world. I mean, I've never believed that Indians are great players of spin too much. But there was a phase in the 2000s when we had Lakshman and Dravid and Sachin and Sehwag, and you could totally buy into that myth. I guess we will go through that period again where we'll totally buy into the myth, because these are exceptional players of spin.
And I think this series also reiterated that with respect to wicketkeepers. Like, if you look around the world, most teams are, you know, go with picking wicketkeepers who are also very good batsmen. And Saha is definitely a very good batsman. But, you know, the manner in which he kept in this series and the chances that he took were just, some of them were just phenomenal. I mean, there was a catch of De Bruyne diving to the left. There was that catch right that ended the series right at the end of Norkia. That low catch. Then a couple of stumpings.
So that was Tejas De Bruyne again.
Yeah, that was a phenomenal catch. Yeah.
Oh, that one. Yeah, when he came in as a substitute. Sorry. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
And then the stumpings, and if you look around the world, I mean, apart many teams like in the India West Indies series, West Indies had the Dowrich not there, and then they went with Shea Hope, and England, you know, they go with they've gone with Bairstow, and then the Butler. And South Africa with de Kock. But if you see, apart from, I think, Watling, Saha, and maybe the Tim Payne.
Ben Folkes, maybe.
Yeah, but Ben Folkes hasn't, is he, I mean,
but
he hasn't played.
Right? Sri Lanka.
I know,
yeah, but
he hasn't played
he was
after,
dropped after that. Right?
That is my point, that he was dropped when he should have played.
Of course.
They should have backed him more. And yeah, I think this Saha selection, this Saha performance should also, you know, tell people how having an exceptional wicketkeeper is such a huge plus in Test cricket, definitely, but also maybe in all cricket.
Agreed.
I probably have something to pick on that. I mean, bringing back Saha is the most logical thing to do. There's no doubt about it. But the fact that they didn't do it in West Indies, and subsequently you had these fairly public criticisms of Rishabh Pant and his batting in T20s primarily. And then that, from there, you jump to a scenario where Saha was picked over Pant, which is a perfectly logical decision. But with this sort of a baggage, you know, I was a little frustrated with the fact that probably they are penalizing him for their stupid idea of how T20 should be played, whereas Pant is probably ahead of them in his understanding of T20.
One of the really enjoyable bits for me in the series, in terms of India's batting, was that partnership between Pujara and Rohit. And there was Gavaskar was on air for a period of that, and it was really, really enjoyable to hear him commentating on the way they were playing against spin. And Pujara especially, you know, he just had a quiet start and he then just took off hitting, you know, boundaries against the spinners. And Gavaskar was analyzing that. And he was speaking about how, you know, he was talking technically about how Pujara was trying to sort of not hit the ball hard enough in the early part of the innings when he was, you know, and often when he plays spinners, Pujara basically comes on the track and he does that little, he almost like pats it. He pats the ball. But then when he took off in that innings, when he started accelerating, he actually started hitting the ball. Like he was like using the power to hit the ball. And there was that Gavaskar explaining that was really nice. And especially given that he was such a good player of spin, and it was nice to hear him analyze that. And you know, South Africa, it's easy to look at the aggregates and, you know, and if you saw large parts of the series, you would think that their spinners were ineffective. But there were these phases where, you know, India's batsmen still had to do their bit and do and be, you know, show their skill against spin. And I think, you're right in terms of the quality against spin. Yeah, it's been a long time since we've seen such great quality for the Indian batting against spin. Maybe, you know, the heyday of Sachin, Lakshman, there was that phase in the mid-2000s, Sehwag, of course. But this is one of the great Indian teams, Indian batting lineups, I would say, when it comes to countering spin.
And they all do it without playing much sweep.
Yes. So given that we have spoken so much, can we at least give a token mention to the 254 that happened in the series?
Are you talking about the most unwatchable batsman?
254s were better in my day.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably, we've taken him so much for granted that, like, a double hundred, okay, whatever, Kohli double hundred, okay, move on. I don't even know what to say about it. I mean, you spoke about Karthik Krishnaswamy. I mean, he wrote a piece about how it's so easy to, you know, take Virat Kohli for granted and not even observe what he's doing often because you seem to know what he's doing. And the risk-free... I mean, we spoke about Elgar and de Kock, right? I mean, the way they... one of the things that really stuck out in that partnership for me was the manner in which they took those risks judiciously against spinners. I mean, they were... You can say that some were bigger risks than others, but each time that the spinner threw the ball up, they would try and go after it. The fast bowler, when they went offline, they would try and, you know, hit them for four. And it came off, you know, on another day it wouldn't have. But that really, you know, and it wasn't recklessness, but it was an attempt to calibrate risk. But Kohli has just taken things to another level. I mean, he is calibrating risk at such a level that you don't even notice it. It's like he's taking no risk, is what you think. When he actually, you know, he's eliminated it. He has understood his game so well that you feel like he's, you know, I can't even analyze much of what he does because it seems like he gets himself into that, you know, phase of, he gets into that groove and then there's just absolutely nothing that can stop him. Was there even a chance in the 254? I doubt it.
Yeah, there were a few chances of spinners, but I think there was one dropped and I think stumping missed and one catch went between slip and keeper. I mean, you play long innings, whether 254 or 154 or 100, right? You don't make big scores without getting some chances and there's no knock on Kohli or any other batsman. You have to, I mean, bowlers... You're facing international bowlers on slightly difficult conditions. So you have to have some luck go your way. Otherwise, it's not going to be you're not going to be able to make big scores.
You know, I do remember that caught of the no ball, right, Muthusamy.
Yeah, he bowled there was no one. Ball. So you know that's fine. You know, but I think Kohli, he's a run accumulating machine. So. How Tendulkar was in his later stages of his career, not peak Tendulkar. Peak Tendulkar was, I don't think anybody can reach that. But Kohli is operating in the slightly off-peak Tendulkar where he was like intent on accumulating runs. And Kohli is a run machine. No matter which format he plays, he's a run machine.
All right.
Let's just close it with the ball of the series and the shot of the series for you guys. Your picks.
Oh, shot of the series is there was a pull of Rabada. I think that's the shot of the series for me. Like, we peacefully done. Obviously, do I have to say who the batsman was?
I mean, pull, who else plays the pull in the world?
Exactly. Fair enough.
forget this team. Okay, the other contentious question that I wanted to address that skipped my mind now that you brought the pull that brought me back to the point. Is he a better puller than Ponting?
Is he a better puller than Ponting? I like Ponting's pull better because...
That's not the even more, answer.
So, I would say Ponting is a better puller.
Okay, that's an answer.
Yeah, Ponting is a better puller.
I mean, okay. Should I don't even know how to answer this question.
I mean, he gave me a binary. I had to make a choice. So, and I think Ponting is a better puller.
No, I'm not. I didn't give you a binary. You started saying I like Ponting's shot more. I mean, you could like Craig Wishart's pull more, but that's not the answer.
Mm.
I like Greg Blewett's pull. But that's just me. I used to like everything about Greg Blewett. So.
Who didn't?
Yeah. But talking about the shot of the series, I'm going to go with a little, a non-Indian one. I thought the six that Elgar hit to get to his 100. And I just really, really enjoyed that innings. And the way he took on Ashwin was, I thought, very special. It won't come up in too many discussions in, great innings, even in this decade or even in the last 5 years because of the nature of the test and the series. But I think it should. That 160 was something really, really special. And I'll remember it for a long time. A ball of the series, too many options. But I will go with the one I've already mentioned, Jadeja to Klaassen. I have a soft spot for left-arm spinners. And that was a brilliant ball.
Shami to Faf du Plessis.
Which one?
Exactly.
Take your pick.
The one where he actually, the ball moves to take the off step. He hits
the off step. Leaves the ball, right?
Yeah, no, the leave the ball comes in. The other one where...
the one that goes out, okay.
Yeah, he plays for the middle stump line and he takes out the off stump. That is
okay.
A spectacular delivery.
Okay, Mahesh, you can list I don't think Rohit Sharma bowled any ball of the series, but you can list even your imaginary ball of the series Rohit Sharma bowled.
Rohit Sharma actually bowled one over. Six overs.
No, I know he bowled, but did he bowl a great ball? He probably did.
Of course he did. He bowled 36 great deliveries.
My favorite ball was the Ashwin to Markram in the first test, in the first innings. And in fact, he bowled a very similar ball to Philander as well. So both were almost equally good, but I think the Markram one takes the cake.
I disagree. Sorry, you didn't interrupt me when I was saying it, but I'm not going to be a good guest and interrupt you. I think the Markram dismissal was easy for Ashwin. Like Ashwin just pulled him to the coming towards the wide of the stump and then bowled one that ripped through the gate. Whereas the delivery to Quinton de Kock when he was on 111.
Yeah, that was also a beautiful delivery.
That was a phenomenal delivery.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was a stunner. I mean, there's so many picks. I mean, I guess from this very series, we can pick like 15 great balls, right? That was how good the deliveries were. And one point of... Oh, yeah, I think you haven't mentioned the shot of the series, Mahesh.
I can pick quite a few. Like Osman wrote about his pull in the World Cup. It's not a shot, right? It's a playlist. So, I mean, probably I'll go with the hook against Rabada. I don't know what Couch meant. I enjoyed the pull that he hit to reach his 100. But there was one which was like a very instinctive whiplash hook that he hits of Rabada. I think it was probably the over before lunch. And I was thinking that had he done that a couple of years earlier and he got out, and he could have got out of the shot, we know what we would have got for comments, right? But now he's well past his 100 and he's on his third 100 for the series and he plays there and everybody's celebrating. But that's the instinctive Rohit hook. And I don't think even Sachin didn't play that kind of a hook. It is a very, very, 80s style of hook. You know, it's probably what Jimmy Amanath and Sunny to some extent played. getting inside the line of the ball and just helping it along the way. That's probably the shot of the series for me.
There was this one off drive through extra cover he hit in the third test match, where Manjrekar just completely lost his shit on air, I think.
Was the bullet drive, right? That went between silly mid-off and the conventional mid-off.
I mean, you can see him adjust the bat the last second to get that angle. My goodness. The timing on it was just phenomenal while making that adjustment. Brilliant shot.
Don't go too much on superlative, man. This is just the beginning of the era. Save it for later.
Yeah, I mean, when... Federer won his first Wimbledon title. I still remember the Hindu headline that day after the final that said the Roger Federer era begins. So I think, Mahesh, at the end of this series, it should be the Rohit Sharma era begins. And but we're talking about one point, talking about the different balls that were bowled. One moment that I remember, which... it's one of those little moments that tend to stick in your head, is that when Kohli and Jadeja were batting in the second test, towards the end of that inning, Kohli had probably crossed 200 by then. And Keshav Maharaj bowled this ball that just took off from a good length. And, Kohli sort of drove at it and then it went to slip. Do you guys remember that? And then Kohli gives Jadeja this look. And he shows him the way the ball is spinning, and it's like, whoa, it's spinning amazing and all that.
Yeah.
and in that next, and when India bowl in the first and second innings, I think it's probably when they were following on, Jadeja bowls that almost exact ball to Bavuma, and Bavuma edges it to slip. And I was just thinking of that Kohli expression to Jadeja, and then Jadeja comes up with this almost exact ball that gets him out. So just something that stuck in my head.
There's one more thing I wanted to say. From 39 for 3, right? Sure, the series was already won. But test matches are, independent things, really.
I mean, you have the World Test Championship, after all.
Yeah, sure. But each test match, it's an independent contest, regardless of what's happened previously in the series. 39 for 3. And from there on to win by an innings, right? And India, they were in trouble in West Indies too, in Antigua. And Vihari, Rahane, they kind of bailed them out. So, like, here, Rahane and Rohit Sharma. It's like this Indian team is rounding into form. It's not yet in, like, peak, the peak that it can be, because it's missing, very good opener. No offense. Well, actually, this is some offense to Mayank. They're missing an opener, another opener, and they're missing, obviously, Bumrah. Once those pieces fall into place, I think that would be peak India in this iteration. And I think they have probably 3 years that they'll fire as a top side. And they've already been number one for 3 years. So I think they'll be number one for 3 more years, at least.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how in terms of the bowling, at least, the bowling attack, if you see Umesh began in 2010, Shami began in 2013. In fact, Shami and Rohit began at the same time.
West Indies series, yeah.
West Indies series. There you have Ishant, who began a little earlier, but who's around the same age. So it's interesting how the three of them, they've all taken divergent paths, but it's almost like come together at a similar sort of ages and similar stages, you can say. Ishant's, of course, played much more, but even then, it's age-wise, it's even the batsmen, like Kohli, Pujara, Rohit, all of them, Rahane even, all of them similar age, right? So, yeah, it's you're right. I think 3 years is a good time frame to give for them to, reach their peak. And then after that, it'll depend on the next generation.
Yeah, I agree.
Excellent. I think we've covered quite a bit of ground. So on that note, let's close it off. Thanks, Sidvi, for joining us. Thanks, Kauchi, for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Cheers. Thanks for listening. We'll keep coming up with some interesting thoughts in the future. Thanks. Bye-bye.
In the air, Srishant takes it. India win.
He'll come back for the second. India have won the test match. India have won the series.
They're going to get back.